This is Audible.
Scholastic Audio presents Honestly Ben by Bill Konigsberg. Read by Dan Bittner. Chapter 1. According to the swim instructor at the Guilford gym, I had the worst buoyancy of any human he'd ever seen. My brother Luke and I got one lesson each as our Christmas present, mostly because Luke wanted to learn. I wasn't so sure I needed to add swimming to my life, as I'd gotten along just fine without it for 17 years. Also, it was 3 degrees outside, so the idea of being in a bathing suit, even inside, was not appealing. I offered my lesson to Luke, but he wanted us to do it together, so I gave it a try. The instructor, maybe 2 years older than me, had a thick beard, like you could hide a full-grown blue jay in there. "You don't have to be afraid of the water. All people somewhat float. It's Archimedes' law," the guy said, and I resisted the urge to correct him by saying, "Archimedes." When you attend a fancy boarding school, it's best not to be a know-it-all on your winter break. He got the class to kick our way to the deep end while holding on to kickboards, and then he took them away and we all clung to the pool's edge as if we were hanging over the Grand Canyon. He modeled treading water, which looked like riding a bike, except if you fall off, you drown. He showed us that if we somehow fell to the bottom, we could use our arms and legs to propel us upward. Then, one at a time, he told us to let go of the edge. "You'll see how your natural buoyancy kicks in, and your fear will just melt away," he promised. I was at the end of the line, and while some took more prodding than others, each person took a deep breath and let go. Just as he predicted, everyone sunk a bit and then rose up until the crowns of their heads poked to the surface. Then they thrashed around in some approximation of water treading until their mouths were above the blue, gasping for oxygen, and the instructor helped them reach the side again. Luke went before me. He's about 70 pounds skinnier, and he did fine. He didn't even thrash that much on his way back up.
"Wicked awesome! Just like riding a bicycle," he said, his legs pedaling water even after he reached the edge.
This was ironic for him to say, and not of great solace to me, as we were both taught to ride a bike by our dad, who took us to the top of a gravelly hill near our farm and told us to sit down, stop our whining, and start pedaling. Mom had 4 gashed knees to nurse that night, and she was not assuaged when Dad shrugged and said,
"It's how my father taught me."
When it was my turn to tread water, I did what the guy said. I let go. I sunk directly to the bottom of the pool in 3 seconds flat. My butt hit the bottom, I bounced up maybe a foot, and then I re-sunk. Like a stone, like a thick Czechoslovakian stone. There was something almost comfortable about sitting on the pool floor, even with all the chlorinated water I'd swallowed and the lack of oxygen down there. Like for a simple moment, nothing was pulling at me. I was just Ben at the bottom of the pool, and I opened my eyes, saw the light blue world around me, and thought, yes, this. A part of me actively chose not to push myself up to the surface. Then I felt the instructor's frenetic arms under my armpits, and I launched myself up with my legs, and we drifted the 6 or so feet back to the surface.
"What are your bones made of?"
he asked, once his gasping for air subsided and I was safely clinging to the side again. I wiped the water from my eyes. I have learned from a lifetime of being a carver that questions don't always require a response. Science classes taught me that my bones are made of collagen and calcium, the same stuff as other people's bones. The only difference is that I am large, like 6'2", 215 pounds, and I am Czech. We are a dense people. My mom's speciality is Czech dumplings, the densest food known to man. They're flour, milk, mashed potatoes, and eggs made into a loaf and boiled, and their general purpose is soaking up gravy. One could build a well-insulated shack out of them. I am convinced that in many, many ways, buoyancy included, I am a Czech dumpling. I mentally checked out of the lesson after 20 minutes when I found myself unable to do the simplest things in water, breathing, kicking, and my thoughts dove into the same dark abyss they'd been in for much of the day. That morning, my dad came into our room while Luke was in the bathroom and sat down on my bed. I smiled, still feeling warm from Christmas 5 days before. Our family is big on tradition, and our Christmas tradition is waking up, bundling up in lots of clothing, and getting in Dad's brown Ford truck. Mom gets to-go cups from our store and fills them with steaming hot chocolate. And we huddle in the truck, me and Luke in the back, Mom and Dad up front, our breath and the steam from the drinks crisply visible. Dad drives slowly through the roads of Alton for an hour or so, and we watch the crops grow, as he likes to say. There's something perfect about the silence, all of us together witnessing the pristine snow-filled fields out there, while we're safe and warm in here. It's not fancy, but it's always in those moments that I most feel like a carver. We're quiet, but we're together. And then we go home, and Luke and I open our present, which is usually a simultaneous, which means we open them at the same time, and we usually get the same thing, as we did this year with the swimming lesson. Call it simple, but yeah, I kind of love our Christmas. But when I smiled at Dad as he sat down on my bed this morning, he didn't smile back. "Got your report card yesterday," he said. "Oh," my heart dropped. "Benny," he said, "how did that happen?" I sucked in my teeth. That was a C+ in the first semester of BC calculus. Prior to last semester, I'd been a straight-A student, but this past fall I got a little sidetracked by my new and suddenly exciting social life at boarding school. Suddenly, I was a straight-A student with one C+ that stood out like a sore DYDX. I'd gone from possible valedictorian to also ran. "I know," I mumbled, averting my eyes. "I'm sorry." He shook his thin, grizzled face at me. "That's not good enough, Benny. You know what this world does with a C+ student? It spits him out. You need to fix this." I didn't say anything. What was there to say? It was my fault. I hadn't done my best. "I'm disappointed in you," he said. "I thought you were better than that." I felt my rib cage expand and tighten, and I thought, maybe I'm not better than that. And then my brain went on this little ride. I screwed everything up. I'm so stupid. I won't stand out to colleges now. I won't get in anywhere good, and I definitely won't get a scholarship. And what kind of future does a brainy kid from a poor New Hampshire farm family have? Would we even have enough money to send me to community college? Shit, shit, shit. My dad was staring at me, like he was waiting for me to speak. He's not big on emotional outpourings or anyone getting upset, so I swallowed that all down. "I'm sorry," I said. "I'll fix this." He shook his head and walked out of the room, and I closed my eyes and felt about 3 inches tall. The worst thing was, he was right. I'd let him down. I'd let myself down. Dad worked so hard, and when I'd gotten a scholarship to Natick, he'd been proud. It was a sacrifice to not have me on the farm, but for an education and a chance at college, it was worth it, he'd said. And now I'd gone and possibly screwed everything up. And for what? For Rafe Goldberg? Jesus. Rafe Goldberg. That was a name I'd be happy to forget. When we finished the lesson and got changed in the locker room, Luke enthused about how wicked rad swimming was. I smiled and said, "Exceedingly rad." After, as I drove us home to the farm across the frozen tundra in Gretchen, my old Chevy, and my brother talked nonstop about video games he gets to play at the Tolsons, I replayed the scene for the millionth time. 3 weeks ago, my dorm room. Rafe in tears. Me? None.
It just kind of snowballed, Rafe said, wiping a tear away. It's tough to tell someone something when you don't tell them right away.
You think? Is there a lesson there, maybe? These flashbacks were happening a lot lately. Like I was hovering over the scene, watching it from the ceiling. The judge, maybe. The jury. Rafe's jury.
You don't befriend a guy, make him drop all his defenses, and then, when pretty natural feelings develop, you don't go, "Oh, by the way, back in Boulder, I was openly gay. Have been for years. Used to do school talks about it. Oops, probably should have told you."
Here I thought we were two explorers, charting some brave new world together. Turns out he'd already explored it and was just pretending. How wrong is that?
I felt my blood pressure start to rise. I hate you, Rafe Goldberg, with a fiery, burning passion that makes it hard to focus on anything else.
Hey, Ben, is it weird if I...
Luke leaned way back in the passenger's seat. It creaked.
Weird if you what?
I was glad to be brought out of my mind rant. The sky was a monochromatic gray in that inimitable New Hampshire way, like God never wanted you to forget the somber feel of the landscape.
Never mind.
Tell me.
Luke rocked his body forward and put his head in his hands, inches from the glove compartment. He scratched at his scalp. White flakes fell to the floor. He snowed.
What if I like a girl, but...
But what? I moved to the right lane to let an asshat in a red Mini Cooper speed past. Luke and I were pretty close, but he wasn't one to ask big personal questions. None of us carvers were.
What if she's fat?
I cracked up a bit.
Who cares?
Everyone calls her Bulldozer.
That's rude.
Her real name is Julie, and I saw her crying by the fence at recess. The thing is, I always liked her, kinda, so I went up to her and asked if she had the math homework, and she gave it to me.
I laughed. So you made her feel better by asking her to give you her homework? Luke shrugged.
I had the homework done. I just didn't know what else to say to her.
That's actually pretty nice.
I don't know. So now I always ask her math questions, 'cause she's pretty good at math.
Sure.
I just don't know what to do next. And is it weird that I want to talk to her? I mean, everyone will make fun of me.
It's not weird. You like who you like. Don't worry about other people and what they think of you, I said. As for how, ask her questions about her.
Like what?
Where do you live? He snorted.
I know where she lives. She lives in town.
I don't know. What she likes to do. Does Mom know that you like a girl? Dad?
No, thanks, he said, and I laughed.
I remembered being a 14-year-old carver once, with all sorts of questions and no one to ask, except the internet, which isn't the same as asking an actual person who will talk to you about the answers. One spring morning, I couldn't take not knowing anymore. All these things happening, all these questions. I got up my courage and went out to where my dad was fixing a loose floorboard in the barn. I stood there watching him work, my arms crossed tightly across my chest, and my eyes trained on a loose hay bale. Finally, I said,
"At what age did you get hair on your legs?"
Dad whacked a nail with his hammer and said nothing. I sucked in my teeth.
"At what age did you start to think about girls?"
"Looks like rain," he said, not looking up.
And then he whacked the nail again, even though I could tell it was already in all the way. To this day, Dad has never had that talk with me.
I know, I said to Luke. They aren't so good for the big talks.
If you ever need to talk. He shrugged and looked out the window.
You're a good brother,
he said after a while, and I felt a pang in my chest.
You too.
I loved my family. We got one another. They knew who I was. My dad can be a little demanding, but there are nice moments too. When you work on a farm for a living, you don't have a lot of time for chatting. Sometimes less is more, like with Luke and me. That little conversation we'd just had was worth 1,000 late-night talks with Rafe. And the proof of that was that just 2 months of sharing my deepest emotions with Rafe had led me here. I thought about sitting on the bottom of the swimming pool and how in that moment it had felt like I'd been completely okay to not be here anymore, to not be anywhere. Which doesn't seem right, because it was one betrayal by a guy, and in the grand scheme of the universe, that doesn't amount to a parasite on an ant on the butt of an elephant. But at that moment in the pool, I sure did think it would be okay to cease to exist. And that just didn't make sense. I mean, I was Ben Carver, and I had so much. I was lucky enough to go to the Natick School on a full scholarship. If I kept my head down and got my calc grade back up, I'd be the first in my family to go to college and then graduate school. The plan was to be a college history professor by 25, and sticking to the plan was way more important than the fact that I wished I had someone I could talk to about the Rafe thing. About everything, really. About sitting at the bottom of the pool. Because I can't do that. When you're Ben Carver, telling someone that for a fleeting moment you thought you loved a guy, or telling someone you thought it might be okay to not be alive anymore, those are big fucking deals. They're atomic bombs, and I don't drop atomic bombs on people. Rafe does. I don't.
Chapter 2. When the announcement came over the loudspeaker that I needed to go to the headmaster's office, I thought, maybe they're putting me on academic probation? It was the first morning of classes after winter break, and as I hurried across the empty quad to the administration building, all bundled up in my brown hooded jacket, part of me realized how crazy that was. 1C+ wasn't exactly probation worthy. Another part of me couldn't stop my heart from pounding because I was sure I'd done something bad. I'd never been to Headmaster Taylor's office. Swank. I sat in the waiting room, which was all wood paneling and high ceilings and sculptures. It even smelled manly, like the aftershave lotion my old roommate Bryce used to put on before parties. The secretary told me the headmaster would see me, and I stood up and slowly walked toward his door, trying to get my heart to stop pounding in my ears. I opened the door.
"Benjamin Carver," Headmaster Taylor said a little too buoyantly. "My man."
"Hello, sir," I said back.
It was rumored that Headmaster Zachary Taylor was a descendant of the 12th President of the United States, which was why they had the same name. I had always meant to research that, to find out if it was true. Taylor was the kind of guy who would shake your hand real strong and flash you a perfect toothed smile and call you my man and tell you that his door was always open. His door was generally never open.
Sit down," he said. "How are Richard and Marlene?"
"My parents. They're fine. They..."
"Right, right," he said,
and my throat got tight. I realized this was going to be bad news. You don't greet a kid so kindly unless it's something bad.
"So, I called you here with some news."
I could barely move my neck to nod.
"Tell me, what do you know about Peter Pappas?"
My mouth dropped open and my arms went numb. Peter Pappas was a Natick student in the 1960s. He was an all-around great guy, a student athlete who had enlisted in the Vietnam War voluntarily after his junior year. He was killed in service, and now a major scholarship award was named after him. Each year, it was given to a junior who was also considered an all-around great guy. Last year, Kyle Guidry had won it, and he'd given a speech in front of the whole school.
I said. "I know quite a bit, actually."
I could barely breathe. No way.
He laughed.
That doesn't surprise me in the least. Your teachers say you're studious to a fault, that you take an interest in just about everything.
Thank you, sir, I said. But I was thinking, but what about my bad math grade last semester?
Congratulations, Ben. You're this year's recipient of the award.
Me?
I said. Yes, you, good sir. Congratulations.
I stared at his desk. It was like I was waiting to wake up from a dream or something. I'd never won an award before. And this one? This was a big deal. Huge. It came with a scholarship for college. Oh my God, a college scholarship. I felt a wave of some foreign feeling sweep through my chest. Thanks, I said. Thanks. Thank you. Taylor gave me a tight-lipped smile and ran his hands through his graying hair.
You are very welcome, sir. We don't take this lightly around here. Your teachers and your coach all had glowing things to say about you, and it simply can't be denied, Ben. Everyone likes you. You're a gifted young man, and you have a very bright future. The Foundation was quite pleased when they heard us talk about you.
You can't cry in moments like these, but it felt like a definite possibility. I felt dizzy and light and giddy, like my body didn't know how to react. Thanks, I said again. Thanks.
Now, it's provisional. The Foundation has certain requirements that must be met throughout your time at Natick. For that reason, we will alert a runner-up. I don't anticipate a problem, but I want to make sure you're aware. You must abide by the code of conduct and remain among the top 10% of the class in terms of GPA.
He looked down at some papers in front of him.
Now, I saw that last semester you took a dip in calculus.
Yes, sir, but I'll do better this semester, I promise.
Good. I think you'll want to stay above a 3.7 to stay in the acceptable range.
I nodded and nodded, and in that moment I promised myself I wouldn't take on anything new that could get in the way of focusing on my studies. Nothing could be more important than that.
Also, the Foundation was really impressed with your activities. As long as you keep playing baseball and doing Model Congress, I think you'll be fine there.
Yes, sir. He smiled at me again.
The assembly will be the Friday before spring break. You'll give a speech, and then you'll receive the Pappas Foundation's 4-year scholarship. Now, it's a partial scholarship, and I know you may well need more aid, but you wouldn't be the first Natick student to pair it with another scholarship or grant. You'll focus on that next year with your advisor.
Thanks, I said again. This is amazing.
Your speech should pay homage to Pappas. You should also share a little bit about your life plans and goals. Kyle did such a nice job last year.
I nodded. I remembered the speech. It had been very good.
Good man. We'd love it if you invited your family down from New Hampshire, and a large wooden plaque with your name and your picture will be placed in the hallway of the main building next to all the other winners.
Me. A plaque with my name and face. I felt full. That's what I felt, full and deeply grateful. I didn't want to get weird, so I just said again, thanks, thank you, thanks. He gave me a hearty handshake, and after I left the office, I nearly sprinted across the quad, feeling ticklish, like parts of my body I'd never felt before were all now very awake and alive. The Pappas Award recipient, me. Back in my room, I called my parents. Mom, I said, I won the Peter Pappas Award.
Oh, what's that?
She asked. It's a scholarship. Well, it comes with one for college. Partial, but still. It goes with an all-around student award they named after this guy who died. It's a kind of a big deal.
Oh, well, isn't that nice, Benny?
Yeah, I said, laughing. Imagine that. I never won an award before.
That's terrific, Benny. Let me tell your father.
My throat got tight. I knew she'd tell him, obviously, but I wasn't sure if I could take it right now, him telling me not to get a big head. My mother said,
Richard, Ben won a big award.
I braced for the letdown.
You don't say, I heard him say. Let me talk to him. He took the phone. What's this, Benny?
I won this award. It's not like a huge deal, but it'll pay for some of my college. I mean, there's a scholarship. It's called the Peter Pappas Award, named after a guy who volunteered to fight in Vietnam and died there. He was a great all-around kid, very popular, good athlete, good student, good guy. They'll put up a plaque with my name and face on it, I guess.
I heard a noise that I hadn't heard too much in my life. My dad chuckling.
Well, I'll be, he said. Ben Carver, award winner. I am so damn proud of you, Benny.
I couldn't help it. I gasped, and then I turned it into a cough, as if the gasp had been me clearing my lungs. I just couldn't remember my dad ever saying that before. But I sucked my feelings down and said,
Thanks. Thanks. I guess they want you to come for the ceremony. It's the Friday before spring break. If you can, I mean.
Well, I'm sure we can get some help here on the farm and get on down there. Sure, he said.
Maybe you can stay over? Stay in a hotel? I surprised myself. I never suggested anything that would cost my dad money, because I knew he'd tell me that he wasn't made of money. But for once, I wasn't in control of my mouth.
Well then, maybe, he said. Maybe we'll do just that.
I got off the phone with this full feeling I wasn't used to in my chest. I imagined my dad at the store telling the Stevensons, maybe, or the Mikowskis.
Yeah, we're heading down to Massachusetts tomorrow. Gonna close the store, even. My boy Benny's getting an award. I'm so proud of him.
I shivered. Careful, I told myself. You don't want to set yourself up for a fall. Be happy, just not too happy.
Chapter 3. A pounding on my door woke me from a deep, upright sleep.
What?
I groaned, rolling my neck to fix a kink in it. It was my first Monday night back at Natick, and after finishing up homework, I'd fallen asleep in the burgundy desk chair Bryce left me when he withdrew from school last semester. I wiped the sleep from my eyes and looked at my phone. 1:44 a.m. On the windowsill outside, several inches of snow had piled high, and I remembered I'd fallen asleep watching the snowstorm.
Blizzard Bowl, baby!
The voice yelled, and I managed a sleepy smile. It was definitely Steve Nicholson's voice, and this was a great Natick tradition. Once a year, we celebrated the end of the season's first blizzard with a pickup football game at whatever hour the snow stopped. My freshman year, the blizzard ended during class, and we'd simply walked out. No explanation necessary. Headmaster Taylor even played with us. Last year, it was a night game, and I liked that one better. There was something delicious about moonlit snowflakes, the way you could see actual grains of snow if you stood under one of the street lamps lining the path.
I'll be right down,
I yelled, and I could hear Steve stomp off and bang on the next door. I jumped up suddenly wide awake and bundled myself up in layers. The other kids might have the newest in boot technology and snow pants, but somehow I was never the first one to whine about the cold. Sometimes old and ratty gets the job done best, I thought, looking at the olive-green work gloves I'd gotten as hand-me-downs from my dad in ninth grade. Outside, the snow was knee-deep, and as I stepped into a virgin pile, I felt the sweet chill curve into my calves. After last year's game, Bryce had lent me an extra blanket, and we'd drunk hot chocolate in the dark. It still was a few hours before I thawed out. That was how I was built. It took a while for the cold to seep in there, but once it got to my bones, it would stay.
Yo, Ben!
This kid named Standish called over. He had stringy blonde hair, and the probability that he would move to Southern California and be a surf instructor in his 20s was 100%.
What up, blood?
I tromped through the snow toward the others. Hey, I said. Each step was work as I had to dig my already sopping boots out of the pack, then break through the crust of an untouched snow blanket.
"Congrats on the pappus," Standish said, and I mumbled,
"Thanks." Word had gotten out about the award sometime before lunch, and people had started to congratulate me. I wasn't used to the kudos, and truthfully, I was looking forward to that part being over.
"Yeah, congrats, dude,"
this senior named Tommy Mendenhall said. Tommy was shortstop on the baseball team, and last year I'd played varsity third base. Other than some monosyllabic orders on the baseball field, he'd never uttered a word to me before.
"Thanks, thanks," I said, picking imaginary lint off my jacket.
"You ready for some serious baseball?"
he asked.
"Big year for us."
I smiled. "Absolutely, can't wait." I'd been looking forward to the first practice for a month, and now it was about 12 hours away. If you wanted to play baseball here, you couldn't play basketball, because practice began in January, 3 months before actual games. The reason was the spring break tournament. Each year, Natick was one of the very few northern schools to participate in a week-long tournament in Fort Lauderdale. The varsity players got to stay at a nice hotel, eat in cool restaurants, and even go to the beach while they were down there. It was one of the reasons our basketball team sucked rocks. I'd been one of four sophomores to play varsity last year. Steve was one of the others. But when it had come time for the tournament, I couldn't go for financial reasons. It kind of stunk, because when the guys came back, they had all bonded, and I felt like an outsider. This year, Coach Donnelly said he hoped to find some funds for me.
"Where do you go over break?"
asked Zach, our left fielder. He was short and looked nearly orange from tanning on whatever rich people's island his folks had taken him to for Christmas.
"Home," I said.
"New Hampshire."
"Your family didn't do anything special?"
I stared at Zach. To me, being home with my family is special.
"All right, good talk,"
Zach said, turning away from me. The guys were used to me not saying much, and I was used to them giving me a little shit about it. Steve gave Zach a chest bump, and the guys started talking about the Boston Bruins. I stretched out my still sleepy legs.
"Carver!"
Steve came up behind me and hit my back with his forearms.
"Yo,"
I said.
"We gonna kill it this year?"
"Yes, it's going to be dead," I said, and he laughed. A lot of the guys were dolts, Steve included, but they were my dolts. Perhaps because it was 2 in the morning, only the true Blizzard Bowl fanatics had shown up. I was teamed with Steve, Zach, and Mendenhall. We got the ball first. Mendenhall called quarterback.
"Flag, 20 yards,
Mendenhall barked my way, and I nodded. Flag meant go straight and then angle out toward the sideline and end zone. Mendenhall called hike, and that's when we all remembered. The idea of Blizzard Bowl was always better than the game itself. I attempted to run through the knee-high drifts, but it was impossible. We started laughing as the sense memory kicked in. Zach tried to make it look like he was running by exaggeratedly swinging his down jacket in closed arms, but really he was walking too. And there was the slight issue of sight, since the brown leather ball could barely be seen except when under one of the street lamps. Mendenhall rifled the ball towards Steve, who had run-walked toward one of the lights and yelled,
"Throw it here!"
The ball slipped straight through Steve's hands and landed 15 feet behind him. It drilled the snow like a diagonal missile and disappeared, and a search-and-rescue mission commenced, with a guy from the other team finally coming up with the ball, plus a face full of snow. Both teams began to realize that the only way to complete passes was to throw short and toward the sideline where the lights were, and after a while, the game degenerated into a game of catch and trash talk about local Natick Towny girls.
"You gonna tap that ass?"
"Who? Allie? That trick? Fuck that bitch, yo!"
Things tended to get a little hip-hop when all the guys got together, which made no sense as we were all white and, other than me, exceedingly wealthy. I wondered if we could get a transcript of one of these conversations and perchance have a social anthropologist sound off on it
or post it on the school website for prospective students so they could all decide whether they could hang, yo. That would have been helpful for me, for instance, because while I can hang, yo, the reason is a little weird. I'm big. When you're a big guy, people just assume you fit in. They assume you run things, that you're in control, that you know what to do. I've noticed that if I don't say anything, people will continue to assume these things about me. Because I am athletic, because I have broad shoulders, farm work, by the way, not the gym, other guys salute me wherever I go. I get reverential nods. I appreciate that it makes my life easier, but it also means that people don't really get me. They don't know what's up in my brain. I think maybe when you're a big guy, it's assumed your intellect is not as important as whether you can throw a ball. We soon tired of digging for lost footballs and gave up on the game. I was walking with the others toward the dorm when some familiar laughter grabbed my attention. I could barely see as the lights were now well behind us all, but I could hear it, about 20 feet to my right. It was the inimitable, melodic, high-pitched giggle of Toby Rylander matched with a thundering chortle of Albie Harris. I stopped.
"You coming, Carver?"
Mendenhall yelled. "Go on without me," I said, bending down, pretending to tie my boots, which were well under the snowpack. They kept walking. My sort of friendship with Toby and Albie was part of the brain-dead Rafe haze I'd been in the previous semester. Toby and Albie were such a weird duo. It was as if they spoke an alien language. And while they could be amusing, they were also annoying. The first time I drove somewhere with them, I distinctly remember this one time as we were pulling out of the school parking lot when Toby, wearing a fake mustache, announced he was a crime reporter. In the end, there were way more fun moments than weird ones. But that friendship was in the past, with the rest of the Rafe wreckage. It belonged there. Yet I moved toward them as if on autopilot, and soon I could make their shapes out in the moonlight. I could barely see what they were doing, but it appeared they were clearing a circle, building a huge wall of snow all around them. Then I saw an indentation in the snow on the opposite side of their snow wall, and I realized that, of course, there weren't just two of them. There were three. My pulse went rogue on me. Wild, crazy, strange, non-syncopated beats. I felt my heart soar, and then plunge, and then soar again. I hadn't been pulled toward Toby and Albie. Subconsciously, it was Rafe I'd wanted to see, and that was just crazy. I slowed my pace, but continued walking, and sure enough, there was Rafe, illuminated by the moonlight and the light of the snow, all bundled up about 6 inches below the powder surface. He was making a snow angel. He was wearing the same bright red jacket and black hat he'd worn when we'd gone skiing in Colorado over Thanksgiving. I flashed on Rafe skiing in front of me, his legs moving from side to side like a pendulum, while his upper body stayed totally still. On the long chairlift rides, his visible breath dissipated into the cold mountain air, while everything around us felt crisp and clear and right. It had been one of the happiest days of my life. But that was then. Now my insides were all messed up about it, and I knew if I let myself feel even a little bit of that, it would be a lot. And I didn't have room for a lot anymore. It might break me in two, and I was a big guy, and big guys who play baseball don't break in two. I wished I could just disappear.
"Snow angels have no place in an igloo community," Toby said.
Rafe kept making his arm and leg motions. I could hear them scraping the snow.
"Maybe igloos have no place in a snow angel community," Rafe yelled. "Snow angel community? There are no communities of snow angels. There are flocks. Everyone knows that."
This was Albie, who was currently carving a pile of heavy snow into bricks. I shifted my frigid legs, and it made a sound, and I silently cursed my stupid, thick body. Toby looked over, and it took a moment for him to see me, but then he gave a tiny, tentative wave, the kind of wave you give someone you're not sure if you're friends with anymore. We hadn't spoken since Thanksgiving when everything blew up.
I think there could be communities of snow angels that have yet to be discovered, Rafe said, hoisting himself up from his angel shell with his arms.
That's when he saw me standing there, maybe 15 feet away. Rafe smiled, a questioning smile like, can we be okay, please?
No.
Yes. No.
I didn't know.
Part of me wanted him to burn for putting me through everything I'd felt since then. The sleepless nights, the need to talk to someone when there was absolutely no one, no one who would understand. And another part of me? No way, no how did I want Rafe to think I hated him. I wasn't sure what I wanted. But my mouth naturally curves down into a frown, and I didn't want to frown at Rafe. So I flickered my mouth just a bit, and Rafe's face lit up with a tentative smile. But then I adjusted back into what I figured was a neutral expression, and his face unlit.
Hey, Ben. Congrats on the award,
Albie said, and I nodded.
We need builders,
he added, looking at me. And I realized that Rafe must not have told them about what had happened between us. A part of me wanted to reach out and hug him for protecting me, but the bigger part of me, the thick part that sinks in water, stayed totally still.
So cold, I said. I'm gonna...
Sure, Rafe said, his voice soft, and I had to turn away because I couldn't stand anyone looking at me when I felt the way that voice made me feel. All mixed up inside, and not in control, and not like a Pappas Award winner. Not in the least.
Chapter 4.
The voice was coming from my closet. It was hours after the Blizzard Bowl, and in the deep winter night, the radiator rattled and hissed. The wind whistled against the windows, and the muffled voice wafted through the frigid, lonely darkness.
Ben.
Even in that strange, disorienting place between sleeping and waking, my brain recognized the irony of hearing my name whispered from a closet. Still, I could not discern whether I was in the midst of a recurring nightmare, or if the idea that this had happened before was simply part of my current dream.
Ben.
The hoarse, gravelly whisper made my hair stand on end, and in my dream state, the voice became dissonant, musical notes hovering around my head. Then they chased me across Natick School's quad, the voice saying just one word, but meaning so much more. Telling me the thing I least wanted to hear. Telling me this thing with Rafe wasn't over, and it wasn't going to go away. It was inside me still, and it was very much alive. It was like Frankenstein's monster, following me, pursuing me, taunting me. Damned AP literature. Mary Shelley wouldn't let me sleep. In the dream, my body picked up speed and sprinted across the quad, yet the voice just got louder and more insistent. And then I was back in my bed, and the voice was saying words, more words than just my name. Words I could understand. Words that pissed me off.
Come out, Ben. Come out.
I thrashed in my bed, buried my head under my pillow, held my breath, and tried to squeeze the thoughts from my brain. But the damn voice.
Ben, come out. Come out, Ben.
Fuck, I muttered, aware I was talking in my sleep.
I'm in the closet. You're in the closet.
My eyes flashed open. I sat up. There was no way I had created those words. Was there? I looked out the window. Still not morning. Checked the clock. 4:15. I'd been asleep maybe an hour. A sliver of light from the moon cast a purple glow on my desolate room. I listened. Nothing. The radiator clattered like it was clearing its throat. Could that have sounded like words? Was my brain so crazy that it could make up phrases out of sounds? I sunk back under the sheets and turned onto my side, curling my legs under the red wool blanket my mom had knitted for me and allowing its heat to sink into my still chilled bones. My heart was pounding from the strange nightmare. The world was quiet again, aside from the wind. I lay there staring at what was left of the moon, feeling uneasy about everything. If I had been back on the farm, all this snow would mean plowing. Here, that wasn't my problem. Yet, that didn't really make me feel much better. I had other concerns, and I kept my eyes open and watched the night slowly fade into morning. And then, the silence was broken.
"Come out, Ben. It's an option. Consider your options, Ben."
This was no radiator talking. These were words, and they were definitely coming from my closet. I leapt up and grabbed the first object I could find, a history textbook that had lived on my desk all break long. It was large and heavy with the history of the world. I poised myself outside the shut closet door, hefting the book over my head as if it were a weapon. My voice trembled.
"What the hell? Who the hell is in there?"
"Go back to sleep, Ben. Never mind."
I yanked the door open. A skinny boy with spiked hair was sitting on the floor in the center of the closet, cradling his head as if to protect it.
"What the fuck, Toby?" I said.
I yanked him up, half by his hair, half by his shoulder.
"Ow! Sorry!"
Toby stammered as I threw him onto the floor in the center of the room.
"Are you out of your skull? What the hell are you thinking?"
"Sorry,"
Toby said, raising himself up onto his elbows and flipping over. He rubbed his knees.
"I saw you going to the bathroom."
I looked at him funny.
"I mean, I saw you heading to the John, so I just took that as an opportunity to explore your closet."
I sat down on my bed and rubbed my eyes, incredulous.
"Did you really just... What the... And did you really tell me to..."
Toby put his hand up like a stop sign.
"Relax. I'm the only person Rafe told about your gayness. I swear, he needed someone to talk to."
I punched my mattress, and it took everything in me not to roar.
"I'm gonna kill Rafe. I'm not gay, by the way. Not gay. Got it?"
Toby flinched.
"This is really not going the way I had hoped."
I looked at him and saw a scrawny idiot, and I remembered just for a moment that he was Toby, who did stuff without thinking all the time, who'd never mean to hurt a fly.
"Just so I know, how exactly did you expect this would go?"
"I'm subliminalizing. I did it with Albie before break. I'm pretty sure I got him to stop eating Cocoa Puffs. I just figured, like, I'd offer you some suggestions while you slept, and then sneak out, and, subliminally, you'd, like, get the message."
"As I said, I'm not gay. Not that it's any of your business."
I couldn't help it. I said the gay part quieter than the rest.
"Oh, okay. Right.
I'm not, okay? That was a one-time thing. Never, ever again. Because apparently, if you make a stupid, moronic mistake once, you wake up with a psychopath whispering, 'Come out,' from your closet."
"As I said, in retrospect, I might have made a different choice."
I laughed despite myself.
"You think?
Do you promise to never, ever do that again?"
"Scout's honor."
I lay down and looked at the ceiling.
"Shit."
"Sorry again."
Toby stood up.
"We miss you, by the way."
I shrugged. "That'll happen."
"It's not the same without you. You have to forgive Rafe. You have to. We want you back."
I shrugged again. A lot of people wanted a lot of things. Didn't mean they got them. Toby spoke again.
"You feel like talking about it?"
I laughed.
It's 4:30 in the morning."
He repeated his inflection exactly.
"You feel like talking about it? Because, I mean, I kinda need to talk to someone too."
"And you chose me? What about Albie? What about Rafe?
Why would Toby pick me out of all people?
I stared up at the ceiling, and I thought about what it would have been like over break to talk to a friend, a family member. If Uncle Max had still been alive, and I could have unburdened myself without ruining my life. That was the biggest difference since Rafe. The lack of talking about stuff. I missed it. But on the other hand, look at what all the talking had got me. What good had any of it done? My brain felt like it was getting squeezed in a vise, and my chest felt like it could pop. So the idea of talking to Toby at 4:30 in the morning about my feelings?
Get out of here, I mumbled, putting my hands over my face. Go away.
Chapter 5. It was the first Thursday night of the second semester, and I was doing my homework at my absolute favorite Natick getaway, the Bacon Free Library. Bryce and I used to joke about it being a library free of bacon, and he'd do commercial voiceovers for me. All the same great library taste, now 99% pork-free. But truthfully, it was one of the only places in the world where I felt at home. When I really wanted to be alone, I drove here and climbed a rickety old staircase up to the quiet loft area. I always had it all to myself. I started with calculus because now the stakes were high if I wanted to keep my scholarship. I was curious to know how lost I'd feel. Very, it turned out. L'Hôpital rule. If the limit of f prime of x over g prime of x has a finite value, or if the limit is positive or negative infinity, then the limit f of x over g of x equals the limit f prime of x over g prime of x. I found myself reading the rule over and over, using derivatives to determine limits. Okay, but what did that mean? I tried to break it down, working hard to stop focusing on the fact that this rule was named after a French hospital until my brain felt like it was melting. Was it possible that I couldn't process this kind of abstract material? And worse, a lot of future engineers in the class were probably not having as much of a problem as I was. After I trudged through calculus homework, I prepared for the next day's English Lit class. We were reading Tennyson's All Things Must Die. The stream will cease to flow. The wind will cease to blow. The clouds will cease to fleet. The heart will cease to beat. For all things must die. It was amazing how something so somber could make me feel uplifted. All things must die. The finite, to me, was a thing of beauty. There was a start and an end. Someday we'd all be history. And if I was going to be history then, it meant I existed now. Sometimes I wasn't so sure of that. I was focusing on rereading that section when I heard what sounded like muttering coming from around the corner. When it continued, I exhaled loudly, hoping the sound would make the person stop. But every few seconds, the noise was there, and then there was shuffling, as if someone couldn't quite find a comfortable position. It started to annoy me, so I crept around the corner for a peek. A girl, maybe about my age, sat in a chair facing away from me, with one leg kicked up on the desk in front of her. Her head was splayed back so that I could see the rise of her forehead and her brown hair flowing behind her. She wore a black jacket, and a large black scarf had fallen on the floor behind her. The black booted foot that was still on the floor tapped away, and once in a while she'd bounce her whole leg and wiggle her torso like a fish on the floor of a boat. The movement suggested agitation, and finally she kicked up her other leg and rested both on the desk in front of her.
"You're not even," she muttered.
At first, I thought she was talking to me, but then I realized she was muttering to herself still. I didn't want to get involved, so I backed away toward my seat. My coat rubbed against a shelf of books. She sat very still.
"Is that a person?"
she asked. "Sorry," I said. "Just investigating the noise."
She kicked her legs off the table and spun to face me. Her face looked to me like maple syrup tasted. Not the color, just the sweetness of syrup. Her eyes were large, wide, and a pretty shade of green. Her long, narrow mouth curved up at both ends. She looked more curious than defensive.
"Are you okay?" I asked.
She laughed, not meanly.
"Well, I'm alone in a library loft talking to myself, so I suppose I'm not stellar."
The lilt in her voice intrigued me. She seemed like the kind of girl you'd meet in a loft in a barely used Massachusetts library while reading Tennyson poems about the finite nature of man. If that wasn't a type before, now it was. When I didn't say anything back, she said,
"I'll be okay, thanks."
"Good," I said, frozen in my tracks.
"Normally I'm intrigued by awestruck boys, but I'm just not there right now," she said,
and her voice was so earnest that immediately all my butterflies fluttered away.
"What's your name?"
"Ben," I said. "Ben Carver?"
"Hannah,"
she said.
"And good girls don't give their last names out to boys who might cyberstalk them on Facebook. Good boys might want to avoid that, too."
She smiled a bit, and when she did, it was amazing how still the rest of her face stayed. It was like a Mona Lisa smile.
"Not on Facebook," I said.
"You still in high school?"
I nodded.
"Where?"
"Natick." She rolled her eyes.
"Oh, wonderful."
"Sorry."
"You don't look like one of them."
"I'm basically not," I said. "I'm here, aren't I? You see a lot of other Natick boys skulking around the stacks, reading Tennyson?" She laughed.
"I do not. I know Natick boys, one in particular, and he was a highly regrettable person."
It was my turn to laugh now. "Many of my classmates are indeed highly regrettable." She wiped a wisp of brown hair from her eyes.
"Mine too."
"Ah, Lana Grace, I assume," I said. Lana Grace was our sister school in Wellesley, about 5 miles away from Natick. The jock guys referred to the school as Lana Dyke, which was not clever, and basically viewed it as a breeding ground for lesbian feminists. But I knew the truth. It was another rich kid school. The lesbian population was likely about the same size as the gay population at Natick. She nodded.
"Girls can be so awful," she said.
"Boys can be awful too."
"Yes, but this is like a special brand of awful reserved for teenage prep school girls. Someone who shall remain nameless named Rhonda Peterson wrote, "Hannah munches rugs on my door in indelible pink magic marker." Very original, no?
"Yikes," I said, thinking, please don't be a lesbian. Please don't be a lesbian. In all the dances I'd been to in my 2+ years at Natick, and we had 2 a year, I'd never had a single connection as good as this one was already.
"I mean, it's not even the rug-munching thing that gets me. I can handle that. It's that Rhonda actively took the time to stand there and write her malicious thoughts on my door. Exactly what kind of issues does a girl like that have, and why is it that I constantly get shit on by people with issues?"
Wind out of sails. Oh well, my posture relaxed. "Do girls make fun of you for being a lesbian all the time over there?" She ran her hand through her wavy hair.
"Oh, I'm not a lesbian. I wish. Men are so fucking lame. Present company excluded, I think."
I stood there, beginning to feel awkward.
"You want to sit?"
she asked.
Okay.
She pointed to the ground in front of her. It was weird, but I sat down there anyway at her feet.
"So, Hannah, do you come here a lot?"
"Ugh," she said.
Bad pickup line from the last century.
"Sorry, I'm not used to this."
She smiled that Mona Lisa smile again, and I had to look away because she was so... raw, maybe? She seemed to wear everything right there on her face. I was not used to it.
"This?"
"Meeting girls. Pretty girls," at the Bacon-Free Library. She pursed her lips.
Are you used to meeting ugly girls here?
I'm not used to meeting girls, period. I mean, I'd like to, but not girls, like multiple, but it would be nice to...